Hello, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, Hobbling Like an Energizer Bunny. You know, last week I was feeling a little funny during the show. We were recording on Monday, I think, and I was just kind of having one of those days. And then turned out about 3 hours after the show, I was just like wrecked with one of these, not even a 24-hour flu, I think, like a 6-hour flu. I don't know. It's one of those things.
Wow.
It's one of those things. I mean, I didn't feel great afterwards, but it was one of those things where it's like, oh, I'm feeling okay. I actually felt, after we recorded, I felt I was confused and alone, and I felt like I should go for a run. It turned out like I hit peak illness like halfway through the run.
The farthest point from your house.
Yes, exactly. So I was like kind of chugging along. I had this like slight cramp in my stomach, and that's okay. I could run through that, you know. And then I'm just feeling like, oh, it's harder and harder to move. And then so I did this really sad little, like, do you ever see people who like are just allegedly jogging, but they're kind of just like rotating their shoulders a little bit while,
right,
while they kind of like
fast walk,
hobble. It's not even fast. It's just kind of like this little, like almost like an Energizer bunny walk.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
I got you.
Derp, derp, derp. And, yeah. I did that for, you know, like the second mile and a half of my run. And I got home and I just lay down on the floor.
Wow.
And I couldn't do anything for the rest of the day. So it's lucky that we got that show recorded during, you know, the lead up to peak sick, because I don't know if I would have gotten halfway through Core Intuition and started hobbling like the Energizer Bunny.
Yeah,
it would not have been pretty.
Well, I was sick last week too. It wasn't quite like that. It was a couple days later, and it was not 6 hours. It was a few days, just a really bad cold mostly. But yeah, it took me out though. Do you usually work like when you're sick? Do you rest? I mean, I tried to rest. I tried to ignore the computer.
I usually work if there's any, in general, in life, if I can sit upright.
Right.
I usually work. And that's not the smartest idea, even when I'm just tired. You know, make stupid programming mistakes, focus on things I shouldn't be working on,
mm-hmm.
Idly browse the web instead of working. You know, there's this like, this sense that if I'm sitting in front of the computer, I'm working no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah, whether that's true or not. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I do sometimes, I most often will try to work through being sick. I mean, it's just boring to be sick, right?
Yeah, that's true. But I do think that's working from home is great, you know, best thing that ever happened to my work. But there is that tendency to think that because you're not surrounded by other people, you're not in a factory or something, that you can just, I'm sneezing, I feel terrible, maybe I have some slight fever, but I can still write code somehow.
Right.
But last week I really tried not to do that. I ignored the computer. I tried to rest up and I was feeling not good. And I still have a little bit of that. I probably don't sound super great, but feeling a lot better until I shocked myself changing a light bulb yesterday.
Oh, no. I'm always really paranoid about this because we have a rented apartment where many of the fixtures are like, I think they must be from the 20s. I don't know.
Wow.
When did they invent the the popular standard screw-in light bulb? Whenever that happened that day, that's when they bought the fixtures for this house.
Yeah,
like in my office, for instance, I think it must be related to the ancient nature of the fixture, but it just burns through light bulbs. Like I'll get like a new light bulb every couple months, probably, when I would think it would be at least 6 months. I don't know, a year. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use an old-fashioned, you know, incandescence here because I haven't taken the time to find the perfect compact fluorescent. But I'm always holding on to that little ceramic insulator right next to the thing that screws in. And it's just hanging from these, like, two electric wires that mm-hmm. are decayed and crumbling. And I'm always thinking, like, well, how close do I have to get to this thing to actually electrocute myself? And also that feeling, if, you know, my, my lamp, my light in my office doesn't have a switch on the wall. It's one of those pull chain things. So every time I pull the chain, I'm like yanking at this giant contraption of death and,
this metal chain.
And then the problem is once the light bulb is out, you don't know whether the switch is on or off. So it's that kind of tentative, like you're screwing in the light bulb and you're wondering, is it going to go on? Is it going to go on? And if the light switch is on, then am I going to somehow touch the light bulb or the base at the right spot?
Right. Well, and it's even worse in this case with the switch, because this bulb was, it's in the stairs, the stairway, and there's a switch at the bottom of the stairs and the top. And so you can't memorize that, like, if the light switch is up, the light is on, and if it's down, it's
right,
off, because
right.
It's complete. It's, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's some formula to figure it out, but I certainly don't know. I'm pretty sure you can't tell. So I said, you know, I'm going to be smart. And I went outside to the breaker and I found the switch labeled, you know, refrigerator / stairs light for some reason. And, you know, our house isn't as old as what you just described, but it's as old as me. And there is some weird kind of questionable wiring going on.
Is it exactly as old as you? Or are you
not exactly
you built
to the
on the same day?
Not exactly to the day, but the same year. I'm pretty sure, wow. Which I always thought was kind of interesting.
Did your parents build you a house on the day you were born?
No.
Oh boy.
But I don't know. I always thought that was odd. But anyway, there is some weird stuff. And my first clue should have been that this switch was labeled, you know, something, one thing in the kitchen and then one thing not in the kitchen. That should always be a clue. Anyway, I switched it off and the light bulb had actually like shattered. And so I had to take out the base of the light bulb without being able to just, you know, hold the bulb and screw it. And so it was a little bit weird and I should have known better. But anyway, yeah, I ended up shocking myself. Not too badly, I guess, because I didn't get thrown back. I didn't die. Obviously, I'm still here. It really shook me up, and I felt like a complete idiot afterwards.
Wait a bit. So what's the cautionary? I described changing decaying fixture hanging from rotten wires, and you don't know if the switch is on, and somehow I don't shock myself. So what's the cautionary advice to prevent what happened to you happening again?
I would say a couple things. Well, first of all, don't. With the breaker switches, I don't know how you guys have things, but like, you know, you can turn off certain parts of the house. And then there's also like a master that turns off everything. I should have just turned off everything.
Just to change a light bulb?
Because it wasn't changing a light bulb. The light bulb had shattered, right? And so I had to get some kind of tool to sort of undo it.
You know about the carrot or the potato trick, right?
I know it now that my electrician yesterday told me that
Yeah, I don't know though. What are you supposed to do with a potato? Are you supposed to hold that with a rubber glove so that it doesn't conduct the electricity into you? Is that a risk? I don't know.
In this case, I might have been doomed no matter what I did, because I didn't actually touch anything in the fixture, like the light bulb wiring or anything. I actually accidentally grazed my hand on sort of part of the. Just this outside part that was not supposedly connected to any electricity, but there must be some wiring thing going on that was bad. And also I think with the upstairs downstairs switch, the sort of three-way thing, the electrician said there's something about that, that there could still be a charge in it or something, even after the power is turned out.
Yikes. So, okay.
But I think the cautionary, if you don't know what you're doing, call an electrician because...
to change a light bulb.
Not to change a light bulb, to have
Manton Reese.
Have a more...
call an electrician. The light bulb is burned out.
I've changed many light bulbs and I have not injured myself.
So,
But also, it's funny because, like, you know, we write code. We feel like we're fairly technical people. I feel like I'm fairly details-oriented. I can follow steps and, you know... and take care of things. But there's something about like fixing things in the house. I don't know that I did. I sort of apparently a complete failure at.
It's something about not wanting to be too performant, because then you might get asked to do those kinds of things more often.
Maybe so.
You know, if you have to call in an expert all the time, then it's like, you're not going to turn into Handyman Manton.
Yep. And they never get there, but
yeah. Okay, well, we are very lucky to have back again sponsoring the show, Nucleos, a tool set of native iOS controls brought to you by the UI and UX experts at Infragistics. Built for performance and style, Nucleos maximizes your ability to create elegant, highly responsive iPhone and iPad applications. Nucleos's data visualization capabilities are unparalleled. Render iOS charts with hundreds of thousands of data points capable of millisecond updates, sparing nothing to achieve lightning speed. The Nucleos grid control can handle massive volumes of data and output brilliant, meaningful data visualizations. Take advantage of a powerful API that is familiar to all iOS developers. Nucleos will thrill you to the core. Find out more at infragistics.com/iOS. Okay, thanks again, Infragistics. You know, I was looking again, Manton, at some of their samples, and it's just, I mentioned this previously, but there's just so many built-in UI, like, common idioms that are either just work out of the box or that these tools really help you put together for an iOS app. I was noticing one in particular that's pretty cool is they have, like, built into their sample app a kind of almost delicious library-style bookshelf with icons arranged in a grid. I think it must be part of their grid view that it's, like, icons arranged on a shelf, and you can like grab one, move it off, and all the other ones just animate into place. So, you know, it's easy to think of Nucleos as something that's really targeted at like scientific or data charting, things like that. But there's a lot of stuff in here too that's just really useful for any kind of information display.
Cool. Yeah, and again, if listeners want to check it out, the sample app is really a good place to start. Because, I mean, you can look at the code and they have forums and other resources you can look at, but the sample app goes through probably dozens of different example uses. So that's a really good place to check it out and see what it can do.
Remember, you can check that out at infragistics.com/iOS and make sure you're following us on Twitter at CoreInt. We'll be giving away another one of those $500 subscriptions to the license for Nucleos. Thanks again.
All right, Daniel. Well, there was some news in the Twitter world again this week and last week too, with some of the Instagram fallout where Instagram decided to stop allowing Twitter to display their images in Twitter cards, which is sort of Twitter's format for how to put things inside a tweet that, you know, more than 140 characters.
Right.
But yeah, I don't, you know, as we've talked about on the show, I've sort of tried to stop using Twitter, my personal account. I haven't posted in over 2 months now, but of course I still skim through tweets when I'm testing my apps, and I still am really interested in any news related to Twitter, especially API news or related to apps. And photo filters, it's a new thing they've added. I guess a lot of people saw this coming, and there was rumors of this, you know, even a month ago, I think, but they've added sort of filters, Instagram-like filters, so that you can mess with your photo and crop it and do things with the color before posting it. So you can do everything inside the official Twitter app instead of going to Instagram or some other app.
This is really rich. You know what it reminds me of is a couple days ago, in the wake of that news about Instagram shutting off card support, I got to find this tweet. Did you see this tweet from Biz Stone of Twitter? Something saucy. It was like, oh, so, you don't want to have your photos on Twitter, huh? Sassy. I don't know. It was approximately a direct quotation. And I just looking at that, and you know, you and I, with our history of scrutinizing Twitter's actions and how cooperative they are with the developer community, because essentially that's what Biz Stone in that tweet is criticizing Instagram and Facebook, you know, by extension of being a poor player in this sort of developer. Because, you know, Twitter cards are developer service. They're saying basically you're not cooperating with us and not serving our customers.
So there's two things that I find ridiculous about that. One, Twitter, if you want to say there's a war between Twitter and Instagram, Twitter started it. Like, because, you know, a couple months ago, right, they prevented, I should have looked this up to get the details right, but they prevented Instagram from using the find friends sort of feature, like, you know, the ability to say, like, find my
right
people on Instagram that have, that I'm following on Twitter. So to basically using Twitter as a friend lookup tool instead of a, you know, posting and the other core parts of the API. And Twitter has been shutting a lot of people down, based on that. And, you know, that's not good for users.
Right.
And then, I don't know, to have this kind of attitude. And Twitter cards are weird because they're not part of, like, the API. They are, you know, they're a definition for how to do something with in the HTML of your website so that you can be displayed in this way in the official Twitter apps, not in other apps. Like, no third-party apps that I know of use Twitter cards. Right. Only the official apps and TweetDeck, I believe, uses Twitter cards, which is owned by Twitter, but no one else. So even to say that Twitter cards are sort of this open part of the API, I think is an odd thing to say.
So I have the tweet here, and I'm going to link it in the show notes, but I should give it justice. It is actually has a semi-humorous joke in it. So the quote is, "Bummer, my Instagram photo didn't show up on Twitter." And then in parentheses, "Systrom failure."
Huh.
Because, you know, the Systrom, what's his first name? That's one of the Instagram guys. Kevin Systrom.
I get it. Yeah.
So, but you know what it is about the tone there? Bummer, my Instagram photo didn't show up on Twitter. It's kind of like a passive aggressive, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, you just want to say, bummer, you dropped support for all of the apps that built your platform.
Right.
You know, I could play that game.
Yeah.
So anyway, but that's my first reaction. The other thing that I thought was interesting coming out of this, though, is Om Malik on his GigaOm, the famous website. I wouldn't even call it a blog because it's kind of beyond that. But he raises some interesting questions about Twitter kind of being so late to this photos game. And he points out, like, obviously photos have become a huge part of Twitter, but they still feel tacked on. And the addition of these filters, I think, is an attempt to try to kind of tackle that. But, you know, they didn't even do the filters themselves. They're using a third party to do the filtering technology.
Right. And it's a third party that anyone can use, I believe, right?
Yeah. It's called Aviary, right?
Aviary, right. And they have an SDK, and, you know, we'll link to it. And that's interesting because that means that this isn't really a competitive advantage for Twitter at all. I mean, any third-party app could integrate this SDK and have basically the same UI, same feature set. I think you're right, though. It does feel like the photos are an important part of Twitter, but as much work as they've done, they haven't done enough. There's something not quite right about the user experience.
Right.
Like, they've done these sort of Twitter, like, photo browsing views on the website, but they're very hidden, kind of hard to get to. The interface just for going through your timeline and looking at photos, I think, is much worse than third-party apps. I mean, most really good third-party apps have nice little thumbnails that you can see as you're scrolling, or even like my app Tweet Library, it ships with like a pictures filter. So you can click on that and you can see, you know, every tweet, you know, recently that has photos with the thumbnails and stuff. And so if they care so much about photos, they have a lot of work to do to improve the experience, I think.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a really good point from Om that he says everything that Facebook does with photos is all homegrown. Like, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Om's wrong. Maybe I didn't read it carefully enough. But the takeaway I got was Facebook invested a lot of their own engineering over the years into making photos a huge part of the platform. On top of that, acquiring Instagram, it's sort of... it kind of feels in retrospect like one of those, oh, nobody was paying attention while Facebook became the biggest photo site on the web. And
I think that's true.
And I always think of it as like, oh, Instagram came along and like competed with Flickr, but really both of those were just little, you know, puddles compared to the sea of Facebook photos that was massively accumulating. And that's where people actually use and share photos.
Yep. So speaking of Flickr, I just noticed, you know, like I said, I don't use Twitter. I don't post to it, but I skim through tweets, and I was just updating the new app and looking at Tweets so I could kind of see this new photo filter interface. And what do I see? I see people right now talking about a brand new Flickr app just came out. Completely redesigned iOS app for Flickr.
And, oh, really? And, okay.
Yeah, I'm about to update to it. The Flickr, you know, Flickr's great. And they've had an iOS app for a long time. It's been okay, but it's never been, I don't know what it is. It's never been good enough or gotten enough attention, or there's something about it that never clicked. And, you know, people went to things like Instagram, Facebook, obviously, instead of using the Flickr app. And I think Flickr, they sort of own this market, you know, they had it and they sort of let it go. And a brand new redesigned app sounds good. I don't know.
It sounds very, very promising. You know, it's interesting. I've been a Flickr Pro user for several years now, not even with any real great reason, just kind of like almost like a vote of confidence, like kind of like how people subscribe to stuff like Instapaper when they don't even need to, or when people who pay for the ads to go away and then leave the ads on apps. I have to admit, my subscription, my pro membership to Flickr expired a couple weeks ago. And for the first time, I was like, I don't know. Because like you said, there's all these other sites, 500 pics or 500 PX is coming up as like the sort of new like snobby photo site. And I just thought, why do I want to invest in this thing? And then I was sort of hopeful that maybe with Marissa Meyer coming back or coming to Flickr, to Yahoo, that there would be a breath of fresh life for Flickr. And I was opining about this last week with somebody who works at Yahoo. Mm-hmm. And he didn't give me much. He just said, Marissa Meyer really likes Flickr.
All right.
And I said, really? And I thought, I mean, it's not totally unbelievable because, you know, she's a reasonable person with good taste. Mm-hmm. But that gave me something to hope for. Yeah. And I renewed last week based on that. And then, so now you're saying there's a brand new iOS app. That is some of that fresh breath of the fresh breath of life that only Dentine can provide.
Well, I always feel like Marissa Meyer knows that you can solve problems with software, make the software great. And, you know, a lot of good things can happen. And that's something that Yahoo is, you know, over the last few years hasn't quite gotten right. And this is looking, I'm just playing with it now and it's looking really nice so far.
That's
great. Just clicking through. I want to say, just based on using it for 10 seconds, that there's a focus on your contacts and discovering photos and sort of a much, much better browsing experience. I'll have to play with it to see how it works. Yeah. I mean, to Flickr's credit, the pro thing is handled very well. It's inexpensive. It's yearly. When it does expire, you don't lose photos. You just can't access them. So like for people who have archived tons of photos on Flickr, is almost like a second backup. Like everything is dumped there. You can't access them all if you don't have the pro, but they're never deleted. So if your membership goes away and then 6 months later you decide you want it again, you have access to everything again. So it's handled really well. It's not an obnoxious sort of, you know, always in your face,
right?
Nagging.
In general, I would say that's the thing that has been differentiating about Flickr over the years and has kept me interested in it, is it feels like a not-in-your-face type of service, right? In a sense, it's sort of like old-fashioned in a way that people could, kind of in the way that people sometimes criticize apps like BBEdit for being just like merely functional. Right. It merely does everything it's supposed to do.
Right.
And I think Flickr is a lot like that. It's not like trying to coerce me into poking people or like putting, you know, weird 1970s faded in the back by being left in the back window of a car for 2 weeks effects on things. It just does its job. It lets you put up photos at, you know, extremely high resolution and share comments on them and look at your friends' photos. And I would like to see that rejuvenated and get more attention. I mean, the thing that, that Flickr has lost most in the past few years, I think, is the presence of other people. You know, the presence of people, period. I'm not posting as much there. Other people aren't posting as much there. And it sort of just needs a jump start to get back into the groove. So
I agree. Maybe this app will do it.
It's a start, yeah.
Yeah. And they, and like you said, it hasn't been the most flashy thing over the last few years, but it's very solid. It always has been. They got so much right at the beginning with the API, with the just the web interface being fast, clean. They got so much of that stuff right. They were able to sort of, even when it was kind of ignored and not been under sort of active development, they were able to survive. And even today, I mean, it still feels, you know, like it's a really solid web app.
Yep. And I'm my new declaration is that actually, Marissa Mayer, the CEO of Yahoo, just based on this fact that I have heard a rumor that she likes Flickr a lot, I'm deciding here today that Flickr is the most important thing in this world to Marissa Mayer, and they're going to rename the company from Yahoo to Flickr.
Are they going to add an exclamation mark to the end of Flickr?
Oh God. Yes, of course. I'm going to add an exclamation point to everything I say from now on.
Well, that actually reminds me of one thing she did really early on when she joined Yahoo is she took away like really annoying, like copyright or trademark signs. Like they,
right.
You know, companies go just like overboard, putting that everywhere in press releases. Like every other word has like a, you know, an R with a circle on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they were actually on the logo, like in the office. It just really, just kind of annoying and distracting. And so she had them apparently taken down.
That's cool. That's a nice little,
just bad taste.
That's a nice little, like, it feels almost like mafioso. Like it's kind of like, you see all these, trademark signs. I want these down by morning. You know, it's like, there's a new boss in town. It's like, it's like one of those things where they, it's like the new boss comes in and just like changes the brand of toilet paper or something. It's like, remember next time you, next time you, I don't even want to say it. anyway, yeah. That's the,
but, you know, it seems like a small thing, but it shows that she's paying attention. She has good taste and just good, you know, sense of what things should look like and, you know, how not to annoy your employees or customers.
The Mayer reign. Yes.
All right. We have another listener question this week. It's from Eric Price. What are you guys using for reusable code in your projects? Source code repository submodules, Git submodules, SVN externals, etc. Xcode project references. Do you create static libraries, dylibs, or frameworks for any of your projects? I work on an iOS code base, and it's growing to the point where we'd like to factor out some libraries.
Okay, this is a great question, Eric. It's particularly problematic on iOS because the sort of conventional way of using code modules on the Mac, which is frameworks, and also the conventional way that, of course, Apple themselves applies on iOS being those frameworks. You can't actually do that for an app of your own on iOS. So you can't have embedded frameworks, as you no doubt know. There's a couple different points here from Eric. First is how to manage the source code itself, and then sort of how to incorporate it into projects. The frameworks, of course, would be how it's sort of incorporated into projects. And I actually have a pretty clever solution for iOS, considering I don't have any iOS apps out. but I took the approach of trying to simulate to the best of my abilities a kind of framework style of dependencies and linkage. So I guess getting back to the question of like how are the dependencies handled in projects, I do use Xcode project references, project dependencies. So I actually have dragged into the, like, for instance, in Mars Edit, I have dragged in Xcode proj references for my, I have frameworks like RS AppKit and RS Foundation, which are just kind of like my extensions to those frameworks. Then I have special stuff for, you know, I've factored out my rich editor for HTML into an RIS HTML editor. The way that works is, I have the project references in there, so you can easily add dependencies to the main app target, and then you can reference the built project, the built products, and then have them, for instance, on the Mac, copied into the frameworks folder. And then I have like build phase scripts to do stuff like go in and strip out all the header files, so I'm not sharing all of my header source code with the world. And then also I have like a build script to code sign everything. That approach, like I was saying, doesn't work perfectly well on iOS because there's no frameworks, but I've figured out some tricks that I'll have to blog about sometime. Unfortunately, I can't really explain it all on the air, but it has to do with basically building static library equivalents of frameworks, and then some little tricks for getting the resources and associated header files into the right spot to let the parent project build.
Cool.
That's my approach. I have to blog about it. You know, I know this is an issue that comes up a lot with iOS, and I feel like I have a pretty clever solution here that I should share. Maybe this question will be motivation for me to get off my butt and do that. But as far as the source control level, Manton, do you use some of this stuff he mentions, like submodules or externals? I haven't used it as much as I probably could.
I used to use SVN externals. I don't anymore. I think there's a good balance here where you can use some of the stuff a little bit, but not too much. And what I mean by that is one of the problems that it's easy to run into is everything seems to be working great, but then you start working on one app for a while, and then there's a different app you start working on, you forget about the other one for 6 months, and then you get into the state where you can't just check out the code from a project right, and know that it's going to build. So, I mean, we've talked about automated testing that can catch some of this stuff, but I also think it's really important that you can always check out a project and build it and run it and everything's fine. So you don't, in other words, you don't get into a trap where you've changed some shared code and you've broken another app. So whether that means tagging everything and making sure the submodules or externals point to just something, you know, works, you know, versioning it or making a copy, kind of old school, making a copy and sort of forking it and then not having to worry about it. You know, I think every developer there's on that scale, there's something that will feel right. But I do worry about being too clever about this because I think you can just end up doing a lot more work.
Yeah.
For me right now, I'm in a little bit of a bad position because I have a mix of projects between Subversion and Git still. So I've basically taken the approach that new projects are in Git, old projects are in Subversion, and I host everything on Beanstalk, which supports both, and I've always liked it. I started using it, I think, before GitHub even came out, and for Subversion. So I have this mix of projects, and you know, some of the projects could share code and don't, and so it's a little bit of a mess. And I don't know if at some point I'll sort of consolidate this stuff and have more shared code than I have today, but so far, what I have is working okay.
Yeah, I remember now we talked about this a little bit with some other subject, but the gist of it is, I think with any of these submodules or externals, any source control system that attempts to sort of formalize how external repositories are brought in, I think it could be very useful, and I should look into more how much that could replace my own kind of homegrown solution. I use a standard format script, a Python script in my projects that itself depends on a sort of bootstrap repository that I use for like all my build tools and stuff like that. And then it just kind of has a formalized way of specifying all the external projects that need to get checked out and what tag, if anything, in what branch, what tag. I think that's what the submodule and I don't remember SVN externals really doing that very well, but I think Git submodules do have built into them this concept of which branch maybe the dependencies on, and then maybe keeping it up to date on that branch or whatnot. And this sort of achieves, if you do it right, I think this achieves your goal of having a guarantee that when you check everything out, it's just going to work. Because, for instance, you could just have your submodule dependency on the external code at a specific revision, and then you would never have a fear that, you know, some later changes to that code would change the efficiency of the code in the project that you've maybe put on the shelf for a year. Mm-hmm. And I think when and if that works correctly, however you do it, that should be the goal of automating these dependencies, is to have a reference in the master project somehow that formally specifies which version of the dependent code should be checked out and built to produce the final archived app.
Yeah, it makes sense. So Eric, thanks for the question. He also goes on in the email to mention a couple of things that we'll link in the show notes, including CocoaPods and another link about iOS frameworks.
It looks like he's linking to a GitHub tool or GitHub tools for managing iOS frameworks, which I should look at as well. It might have some similarities to the stuff I was talking about needing to blog about.
CocoaPods seems like it's getting more attention. I know a lot of people are using it. I haven't used it, mostly because it looks kind of like Ruby Gems a little bit. That's what it reminds me of. And I feel like it got inspiration from there. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. And I do a lot of, you know, server work in Ruby, and Ruby Gems were designed to fix sort of version compatibility between lots of shared code and different third-party libraries. I don't know if it succeeded in that though, because last week I was running into all sorts of weird gem conflicts and install problems. And then you get to the point when you add these layers that you just have to build more and more layers to fix up problems, you know, so you have,
right,
you have a problem. So then you have gems, and then you have another problem. So then you have this tool called Bundler that knows how to install gems and organize them. And then, you know, next year there'll be something on top of that that helps it even more. And I feel like you increase a lot of complexity. And with Mac and iOS development, I've always tried to be as simple as possible. And a lot of time that means just, you know what, release your code as a .m file and a .h file and let me drag it into my project and I can,
right,
build it. Simple. That will always work. That will work today. That will work 2 years from now. And so, yeah, the complexity, you know, sometimes it saves time. Sometimes you're just asking for trouble. So I shouldn't talk bad about CocoaPods because I have not actually used it.
But, when has that ever stopped us before?
Yeah, exactly. But that's why, to explain why I haven't used it, it's that fear of adding so many layers that something's going to break at some point.
Yeah, I tend to agree. We're simplistic folk here, not simple folk. whatever gets the job done. There's an element of that kind of like that same criticism that, for instance, Merlin Mann has come to express many times about like to-do list and getting things done type systems, where it's like, do you want to spend all of your time working on your system, or do you want to spend your time actually getting the job done? And I
right.
think there's a risk with a lot of overthinking. When I put it that way, Manton, I'm kind of proud of us for not having a great externals or submodules solution, because what we have done is we have managed to, you know, share code in our projects and get things shipped.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things where it's always a balance. How much do you want to invest? The only reason to invest a lot of time in something like this is if it's going to make you ship more apps more quickly. And right. There is a good chance that for some use cases that will be true, and you should definitely take the time. But in general, if it's not going to make you ship more apps, then don't spend your precious time on it.
I agree.
The end. The end of
the
story.
End. All right. Well, good talking to you this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the show. And send us questions or feedback if you've got it.
Yep. Thanks a lot, folks. And, you know, it has been quite a while since I saw a new podcast review come in on iTunes. So if you are feeling a little bit charitable this holiday season, please stop in and give us a rating and or review. Thanks so much.